I'm going to sit down, I hope you don't mind that, and get accustomed to the seat. It's my privilege this evening to have an opportunity to speak with, in conversation, Dr. John Lennox. John Lennox holds doctorates from the universities of Oxford and Cambridge and Wales, and he also holds a degree in bioethics from the University of Surrey. He's presently a reader and a fellow in the University of Oxford in mathematics, and also has a particular interest in science and the interface between science and theology and philosophy. And the topic for tonight in our conversation is the new atheism. And the format that we're going to follow this evening is that John and I will have a conversation, and after that there will be a time for questions, which we invite you to take part and to probe this interesting topic. We want to confine it to this topic of the new atheism, as opposed to the 101 other things that you might want to put to John. So tonight's topic is the new atheism, and our guest is Dr. John Lennox. Please welcome Dr. John Lennox. Thank you, John. Okay. Now, it's useful, perhaps, John, just to start with some definitions. This new atheism, what is new about it?
Well, what's new about it is not the atheism. It's the same old atheism with the same arguments, as I can see it. But it's become very vocal, very shrill, and extremely aggressive. So I would say the chief characteristic of it is that note of aggressiveness, that a group of people, four in particular, have decided that the time has come to stop having any respect for religion, to stop giving bishops a special place in media broadcasts and so on, and to treat religion like anything else, put it under the microscope.
Now, you say four people. Who are you thinking of?
Well, they call themselves actually the Four Horsemen. They've just published a DVD, and Richard Dawkins is the leader of them. Then there's Dan Dennett from America, and Sam Harris, who wrote a book recently called The End of Faith. And then there is Christopher Hitchens, who is British by birth but lives in America, and he's written a book called God Is Not Great. And these books are all bestsellers, and those are the four leaders, and of course there are numerous others. There are some on the continent. France is showing a particular interest in this with Michel Onfray, with his Manifesto of Atheism, and André Comte de Sponville. They tend to be philosophers, whereas on the Anglo-American side, there are a number of scientists, journalists, historians, and so on.
Well, if they call themselves the new atheists, the four horsemen of the new atheism, where do you sit on the intellectual map?
Well, I sit on the intellectual map as a Christian theist.
So you're an old theist?
I'm an old theist, absolutely, yes, and unrepentant of it. I see the new atheism arguing that the intellectual high ground is theirs, and I want to claim the exact opposite.
Well, could you perhaps explain, for those of us not so familiar with theism and atheism, what is meant by a theist? What does theism mean?
Well, I suppose the best way to explain this is by contrast. We're talking about people's fundamental worldviews. And we're talking about two major worldviews tonight, really. The first one is the atheistic worldview that says there is no God. Therefore, all we have is matter and energy. All we have is the universe as we see it. So that everything, including ourselves and our minds and our thoughts, is explainable in terms ultimately reducible to matter and energy. The theistic worldview says that this universe is here, it's real, but it's not all that there is. There is a God who created it, who initiated it, and who holds it in being. So there they sit opposite to one another.
Well, how does that fit with pantheism that we think of perhaps with the Far East and the religions there?
Well, I suppose you could put it this way, that in the atheist worldview, the universe exists, there is no God. In the theistic worldview, particularly the Christian one, there is the universe, it's real, and God is real, but they're not the same. And to put it simplistically, in the pantheistic worldview, the universe tends to be equal with God in some sense. The ultimate reality is a circle, that you are God and God is you. So we get Shirley MacLaine saying, I am that I am. That kind of thing.
So you place yourself as a theist?
I would place myself very firmly on the spectrum as a Christian theist. I not only believe in God, but I believe in God's revelation, that the Bible is God's revelation. No. And I believe that Christ is God incarnate. So it's very specific.
I've heard Richard Dawkins suggest that if he had been born in Afghanistan or in India, he might have been brought up believing in all sorts of things, but he was born and brought up in an Anglican tradition, and that perhaps someone like you, you're simply the product of your parents' choices and their faith.
Well, I find that rather strange, you know, because he says he was brought up in Anglicanism and so on, but he has changed. He has apparently ceased now to believe in God. So he himself is a living example of the fact that it's possible to change. So, but to take the question a little bit more seriously than that, that was for me a major question. In fact, in many ways, it's how I got into this whole debate. Because here was I, born in Northern Ireland, my parents Christians, and they allowed me to think. I will say that. That was very important. But I arrive in Cambridge, and in my first week, a student says to me, do you believe in God? Oh, sorry, of course you do. You're Irish. They all believe in God, and they fight about it. And I was rocked on my feet because I thought, could he be right? In other words, Irish genetics, environment, mm-hmm. How could I possibly help it? Now, when you're coming at a question like that, and I compared the two things. Here I am in Cambridge doing mathematics, which is regarded by most people as a very highly academic and intellectual subject. How can I maintain this thing? And I felt the only way was to decide the issue was to actually actively expose myself to people who had not got my background, who had never been to church, for example, who didn't believe in God. And I met with another mathematician, in fact, who was a complete atheist, and we started to look at things together. He shared with me his experience and his background, and over a period of a year or two, that discussion went on, and of course, it gradually involved a whole lot of other people. And eventually, he became a Christian. Not when I was present, but on his own. And that was very important for me, because it was the first example of seeing that Dawkins is wrong. That people can start in one position, and they can come to the conclusion that something else is true. And I would want to strongly emphasize that the most important thing is it true? Not is it helpful, or does it help you survive in Northern Ireland, or whatever. So people can change their opinions. Dawkins apparently has. So I'm not quite sure what he's complaining about there.
Had you ever a period of doubt yourself whenever you question the truths as you thought they were as a child, as a young man, and you had a period of doubt?
Certainly one questions. The trouble with the word doubt is it has such a negative ring. And we imagine some troubled person in the sea of despond and so on and so forth. Well, some doubt is like that. And in childhood and in adolescence, one tends to have a bit of a roller coaster anyway. So that certainly there were periods of uncertainty in my own life. But I found Socrates is a wonderful model. Keep asking questions. And I learned that very, very early on. And so when questions came up, I would probe them. And they were serious questions. They troubled me for a time. But when I was troubled by a question, had doubts in that sense, then I felt the best way to explore this is head on. Because if my faith is not based on rock-solid evidence, then I might as well give it up anyway. So let's go in and analyze. And the more I did that, and the more I explored atheism in particular, in fact, I discovered that many of those questions that bothered me when I was younger were beginning to dissolve, and confidence grows over the years. And I decided later that I would go to countries that were systematically exposed to atheism in their education. And that was fascinating, because there you met people who found it extremely difficult to think about anything else but atheism in Russia and in Eastern Europe.
What
and so
did you
on.
Do there?
Well, what I did there, I was very frequently a guest off the Academy of Sciences. And certainly in the last 18 or so years after communism fell, they were utterly intrigued, particularly in the early days, that I was a mathematician who believed in God. And once I'd mentioned that I believe in God, they ceased to be interested in my mathematics. You can't blame them anyway, but they ceased to be interested. And why do you believe in God? And I ended up in mathematics seminars where people would ask questions like this. I'll never forget in Siberia giving a very learned lecture in algebra and so on, and they nodded wisely at the end and asked one or two questions. And I could see they were bursting to say something else. And one of the leaders, a world-famous professor, he said, "Do you mind if we ask other questions?" And I said, "Not at all." And he said, "We hear you believe in God. Why?" Now, you can't imagine that happening in a math seminar in Oxford. No. Or even in Belfast.
No. So what did you say?
Well, I gave him reasons. But before I did so, I said, "You don't believe in God." "No, absolutely not," he said. "Well, why don't you believe in God?" "There is no God." Well, I said, "Why do you believe there is no God?" "Well, there is no God." Well, I said, "That's, you said that twice. What's the evidence?" And at the mention of the word evidence, he stopped. He said, "You don't mean to tell me that your faith is based on evidence?" I said, "Of course." And that did it, of course. We were into a 1.5-hour discussion, which he led, where they were just fascinated, because they, like the new atheists, many of them, think that faith in the religious sense is completely blind. According to Richard Dawkins, "I'm fluttering among the dovecotes of the deluded. I'm a faith head," which is like a cloth head, you know, something like that.
Now, you mentioned Dawkins. You've had opportunity not only to meet Dawkins, but to debate with Dawkins.
That's right.
And also, you've written a book. What I brought here were just a number of books. I went and raided one of the bookshops in Belfast, where your book is on sale. You'll be glad to hear. It's also on sale here this evening, as Gilbert mentioned. But alongside your book are these books by the Four Horsemen and others that
yes.
Are promoting this teaching. But what were you doing writing the book? What's the idea behind your book?
Well, the idea behind my book is this. I'm a scientist. This book is not addressing all aspects of the new atheism. But in my life as an academic, I was constantly asked to comment on my Christian faith and its relationship to intellectual life and so on. And how could you be a self-respecting mathematician and believe in God? So the more I investigated the arguments, the more I give lectures on them, and the more it was in demand. And in the end, I crumbled under the pressure of many people, including most prominently my wife, to actually get it down in print. And I feel that in this instance, the public has the impression, because of the cultural authority of science, that science has actually buried God. It's put the last nail in his coffin, and we can forget it. And I want to argue the exact opposite, hence the book.
Right. I want to come to the book in more detail later, but let me just turn to the debate for a moment, because I think we're going to see an extract shortly from the debate. Let's just put the debate in context. The debate took place in Alabama.
It did, yes.
Now, how did Richard Dawkins ever come to be in Alabama in the Bible Belt debating with an old theist like you?
None of us know. That's the short answer to the question. It's a genuine answer, because he was invited to come, as I was invited to come, and somehow the idea appealed to him. We don't know whether one of his friends, Christopher Hitchens, who's very keen on high-level debates and taking the debate into enemy area. If you're an atheist, the Bible Belt in America is enemy area. And somehow Dawkins in Dixieland appealed to some people, and it must have struck a chord with him, so he agreed to come.
Now, the format of the debate, we should explain just as we're about to go into the extract, is that the moderator was a federal judge.
That's right.
And you took Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and the judge suggested that there were six theses in the book, and you went through each of them, and Dawkins had a chance to explain each thesis, and then you had a chance to attack him or attack the thesis.
Yes, that's right.
Now, what we're going to show you is not any of those exchanges, because we want you to buy the DVD and watch it for yourselves. But at the end of the debate, there was an opportunity for you to sum up and for Dawkins to sum up.
That's correct.
And that's the extract we're going to watch just now.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been an interesting discussion. I'll have to make my remarks very briefly. I do not think the answer is atheism, though I agree with much of the criticism that Richard makes of religion. I think the book The God Delusion gives the game away in the dedication at the front of the book to Douglas Adams, where he says, isn't it enough to see that a garden is beautiful without having to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of it too? Now, you do a brilliant job at getting rid of the fairies, though it must be said that most of them didn't believe in them anyway. But when you see the beauty of a garden, say a New College in Oxford, do you believe there's no gardener or no owner? That its sublime beauty has come about from raw nature by pure chance? Of course not. For gardens are to be distinguished from raw nature by the operation of intelligence. And what you're doing in your book, I think, is presenting us with an obviously full set of alternatives. Either we take gardens on their own or the garden plus fairies. But they don't appear on their own. They have gardeners and owners. So does the universe. You say there's no evidence of God, and yet your very description of the universe as a garden bears witness that the evidence is all around you. Atheism, ladies and gentlemen, is not only false, it contains no message that deals with the central problem of human rebellion against God. History is littered with attempts to build a godless utopia, each one of them based, as the book of Genesis suggests that they would be, on a denial that God has ever spoken, or even that he exists. And I would remind you that the world that Richard Dawkins wishes to bring us to is no paradise except for the few. It denies the existence of good and evil. It even denies justice. But ladies and gentlemen, our hearts cry out for justice. And centuries ago, the Apostle Paul spoke to the philosophers of Athens and pointed out that there would be a day in which God would judge the world by the man that he had appointed, Jesus Christ, and that he'd given assurance to all people by raising him from the dead. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ, a miracle, something supernatural, for me constitutes the central evidence upon which I base my faith, not only that atheism is a delusion, but that justice is real and our sense of morality does not mock us. Because if there is no resurrection, if there is nothing after death, in the end, the terrorists and the fanatics have got away with it.
Okay. Thank you. Please. Professor Dawkins.
Yes, well, that concluding bit rather gives the game away, doesn't it? All that stuff about science and physics and the complications of physics and things, what it really comes down to is the resurrection of Jesus. I mean, there's a fundamental incompatibility between the sort of sophisticated scientist, which we hear part of the time from John Lennox, and it's impressive, and we are interested in the argument about multiverses and things. And then having produced some sort of a case for a kind of deistic God, perhaps, some God, the great physicist who adjusted the laws and constants of the universe, and that's all very grand and wonderful. And then suddenly we come down to the resurrection of Jesus. It's so petty, it's so trivial, it's so local, it's so earthbound, it's so unworthy of the universe. When we go into a garden and we see how beautiful it is, and we see colored flowers and we see the butterflies and the bees, of course it's natural to think there must be a gardener. Any fool is likely to think there must be a gardener. The huge achievement of Darwin was to show that that didn't have to be true. Of course it's difficult. Of course it had to wait until the mid-19th century before anybody thought of it. It seems so obvious that if you've got a garden, there must be a gardener who created it and all that goes with that. What Darwin did was to show the staggeringly counterintuitive fact that this not only can be explained by an undirected process, it's not chance, by the way, entirely wrong to say it's chance. It's not chance. Natural selection is the very opposite of chance, and that's the essence of it. That was what Darwin discovered. He showed not only a garden, but everything in the living world, and in principle, not just on this earth, but on any other planet, wherever you see the organized complexity that we understand, that we call life, that it has an explanation which can derive it from simple beginnings by comprehensible, rational means. That is possibly the greatest achievement that any human mind has ever accomplished. Not only did he show that it could be done, I believe that we can argue that that the alternative is so unparsimonious and so counter to the laws of common sense that, reluctant as we might be, because it might be unpleasant for us to admit it, although we can't disprove that there's a God, it is very, very unlikely indeed.
Well, that's to give you a sample, a test of the debate, and I would encourage you to buy the DVD and to watch it. It's stimulating, it's thought-provoking, it's at times infuriating, and it's well worth watching. But what I want to do in the time we've got together, John, is to go back over a couple of what seem to be the key planks of the new atheists. What they seem to be saying is that the idea of God is something which was necessary or understandable in the past, but we no longer need it. For example, we don't need it any longer because science has an explanation for the universe, and we certainly don't need a God to teach us how to live moral lives. So I want to take each of those in turn. God is redundant. We used to have God to explain the origin of the universe, the origin of life, but now he's been given his P45 and he's gone.
Yes, and science, of course, plays a major role in this whole discussion. I think the first thing that it's important to remember is that science exploded in the 16th and 17th century in Western Europe. And the main thesis that's held by philosophers of science these days is that people became scientific because they expected law and nature, and they expected law and nature because they believed in a lawgiver. And the great sinologist and also chemist Joseph Needham in Oxford was doing research on China, on which he was a great expert, and he was very interested in why, although the Chinese invented many things like gunpowder and printing and so on and so forth, why there wasn't an equivalent kind of development of science as we know it. And he traced it down to the very same thing. They lacked the unifying concept that comes through the biblical notion of a creator. Now, what you said is what they claim, is that God may have been useful in the 16th and 17th centuries, but we don't need God anymore. Now, I think that rests on a series of serious misunderstandings, which can perhaps be best illustrated by the thing that's often thrown to me. You're a mathematician, you must know Laplace, the French mathematician. Yes, of course I do. And Napoleon was investigating Laplace's book, one of his books on mechanics, and he looked at all the equations and he said, well, where is God in all of this? And Laplace famously answered, je n'ai pas besoin de cette hypothèse. I don't need that hypothesis. And of course, when it comes to the level of explaining how things work, we don't need the hypothesis of God, because God is not an explanation in the same category as science. Let me put it this way. When Isaac Newton discovered his wonderful mathematical compression, the law of gravitation, he didn't say, right, I can now see how it works, I've got a mechanism, therefore there's no God. Because he was sensible enough to see that the existence of a mechanism is not an argument against the existence of an agent that designed the mechanism. And Professor Swinburne of Oxford, who's written some very interesting books on these things, he says, I do not deny that science explains. I postulate God to explain why science explains. And you see, one of the major reasons for my thinking that we don't get rid of God so quickly is a very simple one. It's that each scientist believes, before he or she starts doing their science, in the rational intelligibility of the universe. We can at least understand it with our brains in part. Now, here we have the two worldviews we were talking about earlier. What does atheism tell me? Well, Dawkins, in the book The God Delusion, says, of course, we can't think that the human mind would be terribly reliable seeing the way it's been cobbled together by evolution. Now, you can take that a step further, because if we've only got matter and energy, and as he said in the extract we saw there, undirected processes, that is, mindless, purposeless processes, that boils down to the fact that the thoughts in my mind are the result of the mindless, undirected motions of elementary particles in my brain. Well, then why on earth should I believe anything they tell me, including the theory of atoms? So that the atheist hypothesis undermines for me the very rationality on which the whole of science depends. Whereas the theistic hypothesis gives you a reason for trusting your mind in part and using it to explore the universe, because it's telling you that the same God who created the mind in here created the universe out there. So I want to say that far from God disappearing away from the situation, it's very important that we learn to distinguish things that differ. The categories of agent and mechanism.
Now, the whole topic of science burying God is, of course, what the book that you've
That's
written
right.
is about. And what you're seeking to do, as I understand it, is to bring someone to the point where they say, well, theism, the idea that there is a God who is responsible for all this, fits more comfortably with the evidence and with science than the other explanation.
I think you put it better than I do in my book. Well, that's exactly right.
But having got to that point, you stop.
Yes.
So that your book could be read and perhaps accepted by someone who was not a Christian, but who was a theist, someone who was a Muslim, someone who was Jewish, someone who believed in a God who was responsible for the universe.
Yes, that's right, because the primary battle is atheism against God. There is no God. And science has buried him. So what I want to do, first of all, that book's just a start. I'm writing another one.
Okay.
And that book is to bring people to the point, that is, if they follow the logic of it, to see that the explanation, if I might put it in biblical terms, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, or more precisely, in the beginning was the Word. There's a logos, there's intelligence, there's information, and all things were made by him. In other words, intelligence and intelligent mind is primary, and matter and energy are derivative. That by far and away is intellectually superior to the view that says it's the other way around, that matter and energy are primary and intelligence is derivative. That is the first step. But just at the very end of the book, I raise the question, and it's left as a question. This is a platform for which we might then begin to claim, to study and think about a massively greater claim, in a way, that the Logos actually visited our planet and that Jesus Christ is that Word become incarnate. And for that reason, I am writing a second book which deals with not only the science side, but the whole palette of arguments that the new atheists are slinging against religion. And there I will be defending the Christian faith in particular, because, of course, I can't speak authoritatively for other religions.
Fine. Well, what I want to suggest is that those who are interested in the debate between science and theism really should buy your book and read it.
Well, I would accept your recommendation.
Okay, so that's what I suggest. And what I want to do then is to move to the next issue that these four horsemen raise, which is not just that science has buried God, if we have dealt with that, park that, but that the idea of a God, some sort of heavenly policeman, was something which was useful in the past. But now that we have matured, that we have come of age, that we no longer need God to be moral, we don't need a God to tell us how to behave. We can work that out ourselves. Aren't they right? We don't need God to be good, John.
We don't need God to be good. But I would say we needed God for the very concept of good. Let me try and explain what I mean by that. And it's very important that we don't misunderstand this. The new atheists are saying, look, an atheist can behave as well as a religious believer, sometimes better. And it's quite clear that we've got fundamentally a common kind of morality. I mean, if you take all the people in this room and place before them the kind of switch tracks moral dilemma that we love doing in ethics among medical students or any students. So you are standing at the points and a train is thundering down the track and you can place it on one of two tracks. And as you look down those two tracks, on one of them, there's one person standing on the track. On the other track, there's a busload of people. If the train goes down the first track, one person will be killed. If it goes down the other track, 50 people will be killed. Virtually 100% of people, whatever background they come from, will say, well, if you have to do one or the other, it's the one rather than the 100. They act on a utilitarian basis. Therefore, says Richard Dawkins in his book, this is the example he quotes actually, it's quite clear we don't need God to be good. So what would I want to say to that? I would want to say that it is absolutely right, and I would expect it to be so, that although there are differences between ethnic groups about, for example, how many wives you can have and so on, in general, there's a fundamental core of morality that you find all around the world. C.S. Lewis describes it in Mere Christianity and in his book, The Abolition of Man. Now, Dawkins claims that proves there's no God. I claim it's evidence that there is a God, because according to the Bible, we are made in the image of God as moral beings, and therefore I would expect to find that intrinsic moral sense in everybody, whether they believed in God or not. So therefore my first answer to the question would be, of course atheists can behave very well. And I would be the last person to want to give the impression that they don't. In fact, sometimes professing Christians are put to shame by the behavior of their atheist and agnostic friends. That for me is simply evidence that the Bible is correct. But now let me take the next step. You see, Richard Dawkins, for example, says in his book, we don't need God to be good. But I want to now talk to Richard Dawkins himself. And I'm sorry he's not here with us, you know. He could have been a great...
He did send his apology.
Oh, did he? Right. Well, thank you very much. It would be great because it's so interesting to hear these things directly. Where do you get your concept of good? Indeed, there's a lot of criticism in his book of biblical morality and so on. The reason I say that is he is explicit in one of his writings about what the universe is like. And he said, the universe is exactly what we would expect. And I'm roughly quoting here. If at bottom it's pitiless, there's no good, there's no evil, there is no justice. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Now, I find that utterly fascinating because that seems to me to be undermining all morality. There is no base there for even saying what is good and what is evil. So I want to say to Richard Dawkins, your brand of atheism, logically speaking, and you confess it yourself, gives us no basis for morality. You can be moral yourself, and I wouldn't criticize that, because you're a human being made in the image of God. But what we're talking about here is something deeper. And it was something that the great Russian novelist Dostoevsky saw very clearly, and Nietzsche took it up as well. If God does not exist, then everything is permissible. In other words, he was saying, if you remove God from the equation, then everything is permissible. You've no base for your morality. And I think, actually, we're seeing that among some of the atheist writers that aren't represented here, like Peter Singer and John Gray. We're seeing them take that to its logical conclusion, and we're seeing human beings being seriously publicly devalued.
Well, let's mention Singer because you just gave his name. It seems the logical conclusion of the Dawkins position is perhaps exposed and represented by Singer. Singer, as I understand it, sees no difference between the life or the value of a life of a pig and an infant child.
That's correct.
Now, how does he come to that conclusion?
Well, he comes to that conclusion. Let me quote someone else. Professor John Gray, who's a very influential intellectual in London at the moment. He's a professor of the history of European thought at LSE. I heard him lecturing in Oxford recently. And he makes the point. He says to people who are the ultra-Darwinists, he says, look, give up looking among your Darwinian theories for any sense of progress on which you can base your ethics. Give it up, forget it. Because the trouble with you is this, you haven't accepted the logical force of what Darwin has proved. Because what he's proved, according to them, is that the whole thing is mindless and undirected, so that, and now the conclusion, human life, and I quote now, is of no more significance than slime mold, a particularly lowly form of bacteria, you see. And so he is challenging them, laughing them. He said, the trouble is philosophy has not yet given up the values of the Christian faith, although it's given up the Christian faith. And we need to come of age and need to realize that where we are intellectually is a world in which we really have to construct our own morality. Now, that's a very dangerous kind of situation. And I see that beginning to happen. Because if there is no God, who's been the traditional guarantor of morality, as you've said, if you remove God, the number of possible logical bases for morality, it seems to be a relatively few. If there's no God out there and all you've got is the material universe in here, that's where you've got to get your morality. Either in raw matter, genetics, and its complications, a la Crick and the rest of them, or in society and its evolution, or in some sort of mixture of the two. And that's proving extremely difficult. So I want to say to Richard Dawkins, you are actually undermining morality, and the danger is if you teach that in society, we're going to find that our young people begin to believe you.
But his answer, it seems to me, is to say, well, that might be right. That might be the consequence. But the question is whether there is a God or not. It doesn't affect whether there's a God or not. It might be that if there is no God, this is a grotesque, cruel
universe. Yes, that's right.
And that's the way it is. We've just got to face up to that and make the best of it.
Well, that's exactly right. And I make that point in the debate. I think he's right there. If he is right, then we have to face up to that's how it is. Like it or lump it. But I want to ask the question, is he right? What's his evidence? And if he, on the one hand, is undermining rationality, and on the other hand, is undermining morality, I'm going to be a little bit quizzical, because I want to come round on the other side and say there is real evidence for the existence of God on the positive side, both from science and history and human experience. So I think I would want to start now putting in some positive things, rather than just being on the defensive and deconstructing his arguments.
So the new atheism seems to come to this point that they recognize that absent an external lawgiver, it's down to ourselves to make the best of it, to make up whatever rules and morals that we choose. And in fact, most of the people throughout history have come on a certain common set of rules.
Yes, I think that's fair.
And that's the Darwinian explanation for that is, well, that was driven by preservation. That's what we evolve with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all there is. So let's just make the best of it and get on.
And some scientists are making, mainly scientists, interesting, are making a concerted intellectual effort to do so and coming up with fascinating ideas. I mean, the entomologist E.O. Wilson and Michael Ruse have come up with the idea that morality is an illusion fobbed off on us by our selfish genes to get us to cooperate. So morality is immoral in its conception. And those sort of curious things seem to me that what you're getting is a beautifully scientifically dressed up logical incoherence.
Now, talking of incoherence, the next theme that they seem to develop is not only that religion or God is redundant, but the idea of God is a positively harmful thing. that it's something which should be banished now that we have recognized we don't need him to explain the world, we don't need him to tell us how to live. We actually find that he's been a harmful influence when he's been around.
Mm.
So they want to remove him.
Yes.
Now, surely on this, there are much stronger ground, because when they look through history, there are lots of examples of religion causing divisions. That this part of the world is no stranger to that. Throughout history, you have the Crusades, you have the terrible events in September 01 in America, and so on and so on. And religion is something which historically, they will say, and perhaps with substance, has caused a huge deal of suffering.
Mm. I think we need to take this extremely seriously, because the very fact that this book here has sold 1.5 million copies, probably 2 million copies by now in English, shows that it's hitting a nerve. And it interested me to see an interview in Der Spiegel, which is a leading German magazine. And the cover title was "God is to Blame for Everything." And there was a picture of the Twin Towers and an interview with the four people and a number of others as well. But in it, Dawkins said, and I found it interesting, he said that the thing that got him going on this, and I quote, "9/11 radicalized me." This is where we get with religion. And I say, stop. Religion is, to quote now Christopher Hitchens, it poisons everything. Yeah. And okay, you can say that's extremist religion, but extremist religion thrives on the edge of moderate religion. So the only solution is, since religion is poisonous and dangerous and violent, get rid of religion. And at the beginning of the book, as you probably know, he quotes the famous song by John Lennon, Imagine.
Yeah.
Imagine a world without the Taliban and so on. And when Richard quotes it, he says, imagine a world without Northern Ireland, which I thought was a fairly serious thing to say. If we didn't exist, ladies and gentlemen, I think that would pose curious philosophical problems this evening. But we know what he means. And having grown up in this country, I know exactly what he means. That there is an unacceptable face of religion which is terrifying people today. And we've got to face it. And I want to take very seriously, and I told him in the debate openly and publicly, that I sympathize with a great deal of what he and the others say on this topic. Now, you mentioned specific things, like the Crusades. And they were done in the name of Christ, where Muslims and Jews were slaughtered and so on. What do I say about that? I'm ashamed of it as a Christian. Let me say it absolutely straight. I am ashamed that the name of Christ has been associated with that kind of thing. Now, what I then observe, having confessed my shame, is a number of things. Firstly, that the people that take guns or weapons of violence in the name of Christ are not obeying Christ. They're disobeying him. Because the fascinating thing, and I think it's going to be very important in this debate as it rolls on, I've often wondered why the New Testament spends so much time on the trial of Christ. And I'm coming to the conclusion that one of the reasons is that Christ was charged with fomenting terrorism. In other words, he was charged with the very same thing that the new atheists are throwing at me. And Christ was publicly exonerated by the Roman political authority, Pilate, from that. Of course, Pilate was a coward and he bowed to pressure, and we know all about that. But the interesting thing was that he could find no fault in Christ, because he would have had the report of the centurion that went with the soldiers to arrest Christ and discovered that when Peter raised his sword and wasn't very good in his aim, because he had very little practice, I suppose, he tried to cut the chap's head off and he got his ear off. And what Christ did was to put the ear back on, physically and literally, I believe, although that raises all kinds of other questions for the new atheists about miracles. But Christ put the ear back on, and it seems to me that's not only a literal happening, it's a wonderful parable. That wherever people have taken the sword for the name of Christ, they've cut the ears off people. In fact, they've cut the ears off the new atheists. The new atheists don't want to listen to anything I say about Christianity because of this. But what did Christ say? He said, put your sword back. Those that take the sword will perish by the sword. But most importantly, he publicly said at his trial before Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. Otherwise, my servants would be fighting. And Pilate said, well, that's no threat to me. And in the debate, I raised this question. I pointed out, why is that so? And it's so important that as Christians, if I might say so to the Christians who are in this audience tonight, that we make this very clear. It's the very nature of the Christian message that demands that it cannot be imposed by force. You cannot bring a message of love and forgiveness at the end of a gun. And so on. And we need to differentiate. So that's one side of the argument. But may I say another point on this, Stephen? Because Dawkins said, imagine with John Lennon, a world with no Taliban, no Northern Ireland, no this. And I said, well, I'm not John Lennon, I'm John Lennox. And I said, I want you to imagine a world with no atheism, no Mao, no Stalin, no Pol Pot, no Gulag. What about that? And one of the major criticisms I have of this book is that Dawkins and others, they aren't prepared to differentiate between religions. There's no differentiation. We're going to have to differentiate. But they do want to differentiate between atheists, as I made the point to him in the debate, as you'll see elsewhere. I said, if I said that Stalin's an atheist and you're an atheist, therefore you're equally likely to do what he did, you'd be insulted. I'd be the first to defend you against that charge. You want to make a differentiation between atheists. I asked him publicly to write another book in which he'd make a differentiation between religions. And it's fascinating to me that Sam Harris, this man here, has backed off this position just recently in a public lecture in America, and he says we got to give up throwing all religions in the same pot because it is destroying our own case. It's making us look ridiculous. Because to put the Amish or the Quakers in the same pot as fundamentalist Islamists and so on. So what I want to say is what concerns me most about this book is not the attack on theology. I'd expect that from the new atheist. It's the attack on history. Dawkins says he cannot conceive of an atheist who would blow up Chartres, Notre Dame or anything else. Has he never been to Russia and seen what Stalin did in blowing up hundreds of churches?
Well, he says, doesn't he, that they didn't do that because they were atheists. There were other reasons, but it wasn't the atheism that acted as the motive for whatever they did.
That's right. And I think he's wrong there. I showed the debate in Poland not long ago, and when it came to this point, the audience started laughing. And I stopped and asked what was going on. They had said, send them over here. Doesn't he realize that the heart of Marxism, the first criticism Marx says is a criticism of religion. That's where we must start and get rid of it and so on. And they just said, and this is their communist background reaction, not mine, and that's far more important. They just said it's quite clear he hasn't a clue about the implications of Marxism. Now, I've tried to understand that objection. You know, I don't believe in God. How could that harm anybody?
Yes. He says, for example, here, page 273, what matters is not whether Hitler and Stalin were atheists, but whether atheism systematically influences people to do bad things. There's not the smallest evidence that it does. So he seems to be saying, yes, they were atheists, perhaps. Perhaps they were, perhaps they weren't. But whatever we know is that it wasn't their atheism which drove them to do these horrible things, whereas someone else has said that it takes religion to make good people do horrible things.
I told him a little story to really pinpoint this. The story was, personal story, where I sat in East Germany in the time of the German Democratic Republic in a home where a 13-year-old girl had just come home from school weeping. She was brilliant. She was top of the class, had been for years. And I was in the home as the guest, and we wanted to know what had happened to her. She said, I've just been told I can't study anymore because I'm not an atheist. And I asked Dawkins, have you ever sat beside a girl like that? There are thousands of people like that. Atheism was directly responsible for the termination of their education. And I call that intellectual murder. I just think it betrays a total unawareness of the fact that atheism is not simply a negative doctrine. Literally, of course, the word atheism means you don't believe in God. But it is positive entailments. And it was those positive entailments that allowed Stalin to unleash the horrific persecution of Christians that he unleashed. And if you come to add up how much blood has flowed, then the 20th century under atheism has been far worse than any time before. That doesn't excuse, of course, the religious things. And I think we will lose sympathy very quickly. We have a major job to do, those of us who are professing Christians, to explain to the world the differences. The differences now matter.
Well, they not only say that it's been harmful in the past, but they say it's harmful in the present. And one of the very telling points they make is that the indoctrination of children is a harmful thing. And in particular, to tell children that they're going to suffer eternally in fire and hell if they don't behave the way mummy and daddy and the priest or the minister says is the cruelest form of child abuse. Mm. Surely they're right.
Well, I think there's a very big element of truth in what they say, and they apply that too to teaching young children to strap bombs to themselves and become human bombs, so to speak. I think these things need to be taken very seriously indeed. I said earlier on that one of the things that I am immensely grateful to my parents for was in a country that was characterized by sectarianism, my parents gave me space to think. And I know many young people whose parents, even from an evangelical perspective, did not give them space to think.
And I've heard you say that your father encouraged you to read Karl Marx.
That's right. That's right.
Did it do you any harm?
No, it didn't do me any harm at all.
In fact, I
think it did me a lot of good, because it later was to become a subject for study, as I could see what I would hold to be the weaknesses of atheism. And I think we need to be very careful with the way in which, now speaking as a Christian, we use doctrine. The particular thing you mentioned, lurid descriptions of hell, you'll not find Christ talking to children about that. The interesting thing is he talked mostly about topics like that to bigoted religious people. And so that sense of sensitivity, of not crushing a child's spirit, Christ's attitude to children is so clear. Allow the little kids to come to me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. He welcomed them with a joy. And we ought to ask ourselves what way we are conveying the idea of God and the teaching about God to children.
But they take it beyond children, John.
Oh, yes, of course they do.
And they say that it's one thing to abuse children, as religion does, but adults are also abused, that they're held in fear and trepidation, their lives are spoiled, they're not able to develop without this anxiety about some sort of super policeman, super monitor who's going to ultimately punish them, and their lives are marred by this delusion.
Well, we've all met people who feel exactly like that. And I find when I meet people like that, whatever religion they're involved in, I find that's very sad. And the answer to it is not to define Christianity, if we're talking about Christianity for the moment, by caricatures of it. Because where in that kind of description is a sense of the love of God, a sense of forgiveness, a sense of peace with God? And I would be the first to admit, having talked to many people brought up in different backgrounds, that there can be that distortion of things, so that people are more afraid than they have a sense of peace. And you need to pour the antidote of peace into their hearts. We need to be so careful that we grasp the essence of the Christian good news. It is, after all, supposed to be good news. And so, although many of those criticisms are validated, I would want to correct them, not by giving up Christianity, because it seems to me that some of these books get very near to wanting to indoctrinate children with atheism. And the experiments in doing that I have experienced directly in Eastern Europe have been horrific. So the answer is not indoctrination in that negative sense in both directions, but teaching children in a loving environment and adults and all the rest of it, so that all these doctrines get put in correct proportion. Because you cannot, if the first commandment, for example, is love the Lord your God with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength, you can't induce that by fear. And the trouble is, there are brutal religious people around. I would confess that to Richard Dawkins, who love to be king among kids and browbeat them and so on and so forth. And that is a horrific thing.
Now, you talked about loving God and the good news.
Yes.
One of the points that Dawkins seems to get most agitated about is the idea of a God who punishes.
Yes.
And the God who punishes in particular Jesus, the idea of the atonement,
yes,
he seems to find repulsive, and he describes it in terms which are very strong.
Yes. Well, Dawkins spends less time on it than Christopher Hitchens, who describes it in lurid detail in his God is Not Great. Well, he simply asserts that it's immoral. Well, I'm not very impressed with that, because first of all, he says it's immoral, and I think I wouldn't want to misquote him. I don't have the exact quotation in my mind, but he says he can understand somebody paying a fine for someone else or somebody even dying for someone else. But the idea that if I have offended you, if I've sinned against you, that the third party could come in and say you're forgiven without consulting you is utterly absurd. Well, yes, it is. Hitchens is completely right, unless the third party is God. And what I think he hasn't taken on board, he simply makes the assertion, there's no evidence for it. He simply states it's immoral. I don't think it is, if the third party involved is God. But let's step back just a minute, because the first part of your question had to do with something I think is immensely important in this whole debate. A lot of the criticisms of God are that God judges, and various descriptions made of that. But I would want to argue that a world without judgment, Dawkins, of course, doesn't believe there is a God, so there's no final judgment, is a world without hope. Because what he doesn't say, and it's what these books don't say, that moves me greatly. They have no hope. They are, strictly speaking, atheism is a hopeless faith. It is a faith, of course, although Dawkins
doesn't accept that.
Because, again, as I pointed out just in that last extract, which was heavily compressed, ladies and gentlemen, because the radio people told us we had to finish in 2 minutes rather than seven, so it cut the last little bit of the DV down terribly. The point I was trying to make there is this, that we human beings have an inbuilt sense of justice. Now, if there is no God, and say I'm a terrorist, or I'm a dictator, I'm a Stalin, or I'm a Pol Pot, and I live my life as I like, I murder millions of people, I live in absolute luxury, and if the enemy gets to me in the end, I just put a pistol in my brains, I blow it out, that's the finish. So, I've had it all my way. We got to die sometime. I've escaped scot-free. That contradicts every sense of justice we've got. And what I find so ironical is that Dawkins saying we can't have God as judge when that's the very thing he needs to give the universe moral stability. Of course, his caricature of God's judgment is another matter. But the notion that there is to be a totally fair final assessment is one that I find enormously encouraging, being a person who's visited Auschwitz many times and having to talk to people who are hurting, as many people are, desperately hurting. Will it ever be put right? Ask atheism what kind of a world it's bringing you to. It's a world in which nothing will ever be put right, except the things we can put right in this life. It is totally hopeless. Now, of course, it may be true,
yeah,
as you were saying, but we need to be very sure it is true. And we need to, I would say, be wary of going down the atheist route simply because of a caricature of a doctrine of judgment, that is, by Dawkins, which is actually a wonderful thing. And I'm very struck by some of the expressions in Hebrew poetry in the Old Testament where The writer of Psalms would say, let the trees clap and the mountains sing and the earth rejoice because God is coming to judge. And you say, what? Why should I rejoice that God is coming to judge? Well, you would if you ended your days in a gas chamber. You would if you lost a child who'd been shot by a paramilitary and so on and so forth. Is it ever going to be put right? And it seems to me the two things then come together. The doctrine of the atonement and the doctrine of justice. If Jesus Christ is really God, then on the cross we're being shown a whole lot of things, but one of them in particular is the fact that God hasn't remained distant from human suffering. He's actually become part of it. And that gives me a real window of hope. Atheism knows absolutely nothing of that. And so, therefore, coming back to that key question, is it true or is it not? It now begins to focus to me down to very sharp focus on the events of 20 centuries ago. And is that story credible? And then we come to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And then the new atheists pile in with all their objections to miracles and everything else in the name of science.
That sounds like another book, John.
Do you think that's a good idea?
Another book. It was John Stott, I think, who said that in the atonement it's God himself who gave himself to save us from himself, which seems to be what you're saying.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think there's something very deep. It is, of course, a mystery. And I'm not embarrassed by that in the slightest. I mean, after all, my atheist scientific friends and my non-atheist physicist friends, they don't know what energy is. Energy is simple stuff compared to the atonement. And if they can't explain what energy is, we oughtn't to be embarrassed that the deepest thing in the whole of God's universe, how we can have a firm basis for peace and a relationship with him if we don't understand all the mechanics of it. Why should we believe it? Not because we understand it all, we understand some of it, but because it makes sense and because there's evidence for it.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Dr. John Lennox. Now we have time for questions from the floor. The way we propose to do this is that we want the questions to be focused, please, on the topic that we were discussing this evening, rather than the many other things that doubtless you're interested to speak to John about. So on the topic of the new atheism, I'd like to gather up a series of questions which John will then take. So we'll not take one at a time, we'll take a handful of questions which John will then address.
Well, let's have a go at these, and Stephen, you feel quite happy to join in with your reflections on them as well. The first question was simply, who is defending? Well, I think lots of people are defending at different levels. I do, Alistair McGrath, a colleague and friend at Oxford, has done a lot of the being prepared to put his head above the parapet and be counted all around the place. But there are, of course, other people who are debating these things in North America. There are some very eminent philosophers like Alvin Plantinga, eminent theologians like Don Carson, and so on and so forth. So there are people doing it. I think that if I might just speak to the Christians among us for a moment, that it's incumbent upon all of us not to be silent. The great danger is to give the impression that there's nobody standing up for God. There was a headline in one of our tabloid newspapers a few months ago, "Who will stand up for God?" And it actually really resonated with me. And I thought, well, if the opportunity comes, we've got to do what we can. We are required by our faith to defend it in an age and in a culture that has many questions about it. But if you look on the internet, you will find there are many debates going on at the moment. Just type in Christopher Hitchens in particular. If you want to know who's debating on the Christian side, type in Hitchens, because he does a lot more debating than Dawkins. Dawkins, up until he debated me, his argument was, I won't debate anybody because that legitimizes them. And that was the argument that was used for that. Now, the second question was, about the size of the universe. And I am an amateur astronomer. I've got a telescope, and there's nothing I like more than to get out into the back garden and to look through it at the Ring Nebula or Andromeda Galaxy and think of just the 100 of billions of stars. And of course, the immediate reaction is to say how tiny human beings are, and they are on a linear scale. On a logarithmic scale, those of you who are interested in mathematics, human beings come almost exactly between the size of a galaxy and the size of an atom. That's a different story. Perhaps that doesn't appeal to any of you. But it's a serious question, and it raises a number of issues. One is size the measure of value? Well, ask any woman whether she'd rather have a huge rock or a tiny little diamond. And you'll see whether size in itself is a criterion of value. But there are far more interesting scientific things there. You see, we are told that we're made of carbon. Well, where does the carbon come from? Well, I'm told it comes from the star furnaces. And you need a certain period of time to elapse for stars to go through various cycles and so on until you can get the heavier elements. So it may be that both the great age and the great spaces are necessary in order to get even a solar system like ours. I don't know. The other thing is this, that it's very interesting that most names have been given to things by scientists. Science is the job of naming things. In fact, most intellectual disciplines are. But there are one or two bits of the universe that God himself gave names to, according to the Bible, that is. And one of them is heaven. God called the sky heaven. Why did he do that? Wasn't that a bit dangerous? Wouldn't that be a little bit ambiguous if heaven was the realm in which God lives, wherever or whatever that is? And I think not, because every artist, musician, and even ourselves as we go out and look up, there's something about the wonder, the spectacular beauty, especially if you see it through the lens of the Hubble telescope, that produces in us a sense of majesty and awe. It's meant to, I would want to say. That aesthetic sense that, from my perspective, is placed in us by God. God educates us through showing us. Just think, if the earth was covered permanently by thick cloud, it would have been centuries before we'd been able to send something up to see that there was anything beyond it. But interestingly enough, we live on an earth where we occasionally, at least in Northern Ireland, very occasionally, can see that there is a sun up there, and there are stars and the moon and so on. So I don't feel that size determines importance. And my final point on that, which would be a biblical point, is this. That the very interesting thing to me is this, that one of the scientists' famous psalms in the Old Testament is, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the earth shows his handiwork." There is a magnificence out there. So that's what the heavens do. They show us the glory of God. But the heavens weren't made in God's image. You are. Now that's the value scale that makes most sense to me. So that means that you're more important than the sun. It's beautiful. It wasn't made in God's image. You are. And that particular viewpoint is something that atheism knows absolutely nothing about, which incidentally we haven't really discussed tonight except obliquely. One of the things I ask about worldviews and systems of thought when I meet them is, what is their value of a human being? And here is something simply staggeringly magnificent, that you and I, somehow, in some sense, we bear the imprint of the character of God. We're made in the image of God. That puts the perspective right. It's very good that the universe should diminish us in the sense that we feel tiny. But now let's reflect on it the other way around. What God has revealed is we may be tiny in one sense, but we've got immeasurable stature. You will exist long after the sun has blown up.
Lewis makes a point, doesn't he, about there is no ordinary individual.
That's right, yes.
That if we could see people as they will eventually be, we would be tempted to fall and worship before.
That's exactly right. And it's Lewis, you remind me, who makes the point that some of these people argue, you know, we now know these vast distances. The ancient world didn't know them. And of course, they thought we were very important. And Lewis was one of the early people to point out that that was simply not true, that in the literature you could still find this sense of immensity, although they hadn't the measuring faculties to do it. Now, there was a question about justice. How would you explain to a Jewish family about an SS officer becoming a Christian? I'm always slightly wary of examples. I don't know whether that's a real life example. If it actually is, I'd like to know about it. I've had many times to sit with Jewish families and try to talk to them about Auschwitz in itself. And I think this kind of an area is so searingly painful that explanations can only be given bit by bit. It's one thing to have an intellectual solution, you may think, to the problem of suffering. When you're not going through it, it's another thing entirely to be going through it. And that searing pain, and I have met it many times. So I would first of all not want to talk about the specific of that man becoming a Christian. Can you forgive him? It may take years and years for people to overcome the hurt, to reach out in forgiveness where there is repentance. And Stephen mentioned the thing I was actually going to mention myself, that experience of Corrie ten Boom, who was in Ravensbrück on various prison camps in Germany and found herself speaking on her Christian faith. And she was speaking in an audience when she recognized one of the brutal camp guards sitting in the audience. And he came out with the tears, saying that he'd repented and could she forgive him. And it was an absolutely staggering moment for her. I'll not spoil it for you. It's well worth, I think the questioner ought to go and get Corrie ten Boom's book and read it and see if that yields the beginnings of a question. There have been magnificent acts of forgiveness. The most magnificent of all, of course, was Christ himself. And again, it seems to me in this area, which is not covered by science, of course, but is so real to each one of us. If we don't have any answers here, and I don't think atheism gives us any at all, then we are, in my view at least, seriously impoverished. Now, the next question is, what is driving these four horsemen to be so active against religion? Well, I think in one sense we can believe what they say. They are fed up with politicians who are afraid to trace violence to its religious roots. They are fed up with giving what they call respect to religious figures. If it's a bishop, if it's an imam, we've got to bow down and listen to what they say. Why not treat it as we treat everything else? There's an awful lot of truth in that. They also want to, and I quote Dawkins here, raise people's consciousness. They genuinely feel that those of us who believe in God are faith heads and cloth heads, and we're hindering the progress of civilization. Now, I know there are some cynics, and I'm not going to be a cynic tonight, who also say there's an enormous amount of money in it. And there is, of course. There's a very big amount of money, but I think that would be rather hitting below the belt, because it's obviously resonating with people. And the question I want to ask that question. And I would throw the thing back at myself and put it this way. Where have I failed as a Christian in explaining my faith so that this kind of thing gets such a resonance among the public? That is the real question that comes out of it for me. Where have I failed? Why is it that we who are Christians, and some of us in this audience are, some are not, but why is it that those of us who are Christians have not made our faith credible, How are we not taking our faith as seriously as the new atheists are taking their faith? Are we prepared to spread it as strongly as they do? That's the kind of the challenge that reaches me. Now, there was a related question. This business of human rights, how do the new atheists explain the drive for human rights? Well, I'm not sure that I don't know whether you have read much about the new atheists trying to explain the drive for human rights. All I can say is this. I was in Brussels recently, invited to speak to various people involved in the EU on where do we get ethics in a European pluralist society in the 21st century, because they're worried, very worried, where we get these rights and values from. Because what I have noticed in my limited experience is the question of where values come from, who said so, is the question that many people want to completely avoid, and we can't avoid it. And what I wanted to say to those people, and did say to them, was on the one hand, there is this common pool of values. If it didn't exist, society would collapse completely. But the thing we need to be very wary of in Europe is some worldviews, particularly this kind of atheism, are actually, whether they see it or not, undermining those traditional values. And therefore, they're liable to be believed by young people, which could turn some of our countries into binge cultures, apart from anything else. So I don't know whether you want to comment, because you are a lawyer and the human rights thing.
No, I'm content to leave it there.
Yes, right. Well,
Partly because I'm normally paid for my answers, John.
Do you know,
and if you want to speak to me now, afterwards, Brian.
Do you see, he waited to say that till nearly the very end. Do you know, could we start again? And I'll set it right.
Okay.
Now, there was a final question here. How do the new atheists propose to rid the world of religion?
Without
force. Well, Dawkins, in some of his writings, comes perilously near to a totalitarian attitude. What worries me, as I mentioned before, but let me recontextualize it, what worries me about the airbrushing out of 20th century history of communism and so on, and of atheism, I can understand these people wanting to airbrush it out. Because if they leave it in, it's a very small step to say, well, gentlemen, are you proposing a similar thing? Because forced atheism has been tried. And it has led to the greatest bloodbath history has ever seen. You need to be very careful. Now, that's why all my alarm antennae go up when I see that they are denying history. The denial of history is a very serious thing, ladies and gentlemen. It is totalitarian thinking that rewrites history. And that is what worries me. And perhaps we shall see how they propose to do it. And I suspect a little bit of indoctrination will not be beyond them. Dawkins, after all, has started his Richard Dawkins Foundation for Rationality and Science, or something like this, RDFRS, which is just what his name is, Fellow of the Royal Society. And that foundation has put a lot of money into sending literature into schools. So they are certainly prepared to educate the next generation of children in atheism. I hope they keep away from increasing the pressure, but there are certain elements in these books, and you need to read them for yourselves to come to a judgment, which do frighten me. But the rewriting of history is the most serious one. We must, it seems to me, we must, in our society, learn the meaning of true as distinct from false tolerance. Tolerance used to mean that I would respect and protect your right to disagree with me publicly if necessary. Tolerance has generated in many of our Western civilized nations into a political paralyzing correctness that you daren't say what you believe to be the truth in case you'd offend somebody. And Dawkins says in his book, it's very difficult to be an atheist. What part of the world he's talking about? He may be talking about parts of the United States. He's not talking about Europe. Because it's becoming increasingly difficult to confess that you are a Christian in Europe. And certainly we can see that there are cases of discrimination. And it seems to me that there's half an eye, if not more than half an eye, on an American potential audience in that book than there is in a realistic view of Europe. Let's get the truth out and discuss it. And that is why I would like to thank you enormously for your invitation to Stephen for his brilliant series of questions that made it so easy for me, that this is what we need to do, to have constant discussion of these ideas and go away and as free men and women in a relatively free society, make up our own minds and then spread the discussion in the same civilized way.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of you, I'd like to thank Dr. John Lennox for being our guest this evening. Will you please show your appreciation?
Thank you again for coming. In addition to thanking John on your behalf, I think we should thank Stephen Shaw. So please show your appreciation to Stephen. As I said at the start, John's book is available. It's on sale in the foyer as you go out. Also the DVD from the debates in Birmingham, Alabama. John will also be here in the morning to speak on the topic, A Reason for Hope, as part of a church service here. So if you would wish to hear him again on that topic, please join us either at 9:30 or 11:30 in the morning. But thank you so much for coming. Do take care on the way. The rain has been unrelenting. You probably need your boat rather than your car to get you home. So thank you very much and good night.